This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
When nonprofit hospitals still make plenty of money. From Marketplace in New York, I'm David Brancaccio. We'll lead with a paradox from the business of healthcare. Data published today that some of the most profitable hospitals are nonprofits. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Dan Gorenstein reports the analysis in the journal Health Affairs raises questions about those institutions' tax status.
Seven of the top 10 most profitable hospitals in 2013 were nonprofits. One in Wisconsin with more than $300 million. Johns Hopkins economist Gerard Anderson says these hospitals tend to spend their money in several ways.
The most common thing they do is buy more hospitals. They also might use it for buildings or new equipment. And finally, some of them just accumulate it and have very large endowments.
Anderson says when it comes to coveted tax-exempt nonprofit status, the question is, should hospitals be allowed to amass that kind of money? The American Hospital Association's legal counsel, Melinda Hatton, says there's no link between profitability and tax status.
The initial test for tax-exempt status really is about access. And really, the doors need to be open to everybody in the community to make sure that they are provided with the care that they need.
Hatton says the nonprofits are investing in their institutions, totally in line with their responsibilities. Critics worry those investments end up shutting some patients out. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Now to slowing economic growth in a region with 800 million people, more than one of every 10 people on Earth. It's a new report from the International Monetary Fund covering sub-Saharan Africa. After years of growth fueled by oil production and mining, the IMF says growth is now the lowest in 15 years in that region. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has reported from the area and joins us now. Kimberly, we have low oil prices to blame for the slower growth, but what else is dragging down these economies?
So the IMF says there have been multiple shocks all at once that have growth at 3.5% last year for sub-Saharan Africa overall, and that's expected to drop down to 3% this year. So obviously we have low oil prices hitting the oil and extraction industries in places like Nigeria and Angola, but then the slowdown in other commodity sectors is hitting Ghana and South Africa and Zambia, as well as a severe drought in countries like Ethiopia, Malawi, and Zimbabwe. And then on top of that, you also have tighter financing in global markets, which means it's not so easy to get loans to fund the government or get funding for big infrastructure projects.
But, you know, 3 or 3.5% annualized growth might not look so bad compared to U.S. growth now running at 1%. But I guess watch out for the comparison.
Right. This was a region that was growing at about 6% over the last decade, and these new numbers, according to the IMF, barely keep up with population growth. And as you mentioned, I spent some time reporting in sub-Saharan Africa over the last few years, and you could really see the impact of those commodity dollars and the influx of global investment, especially from China, and that's the kind of growth that's at risk. Nevertheless, those years of growth did create a new middle class and spur development that makes the IMF say the region probably still has a good medium-term growth prospect.
Marketplace's Kimberly Adams, thank you. Microfinance loans, $25, $1,500, that kind of range, became a buzzword in the fight against world poverty after Muhammad Yunus won a Nobel Prize 10 years ago for his special bank in Bangladesh. Microfinance can be exploitative or beneficial, depending on the lender and the structure of the deal. But the idea has spread around the world to countries like Colombia. There, up to 50% of the economy consists of small businesses that might otherwise get funded by loan sharks. Lauren Madelon reports from Bogota.
Microloans are big business in Colombia. The idea? Loan to people like Elizabeth Abella, who can't get credit. She's in a steamy cinder block kitchen in Barranquilla on the Caribbean coast. She explains she's making beans in a pressure cooker for the lunchtime crowd.
Olla de presión que se le llama aquí en Colombia.
She got her microloan from Opportunity International, a Christian faith-based nonprofit. She says her $150 loan means hope for a better future. So how does someone with no collateral get some? Well, the organization champions something called a trust group. They're common in microlending. If someone defaults, everyone else is supposed to pick up the tab. In Bogota, a different approach. For-profit microfinance banks. There are seven here. The World Bank's invested in one, Banca Mia. Here's Banca Mia senior VP, Margarita Correa Inau.
Las personas de la base de la pirámide.
Helping people at the bottom of the pyramid isn't just altruistic, she says. It makes a lot of money. Microfinance isn't sustainable without profits, she says.
Eso es industria.
This is a business, period, she says. Collaterals put up by foundations or farming cooperatives. You file a business plan. If you make the cut, you're paired with a formally trained banker.
Microfinance is one of these ideas that sounds really good in theory.
George Washington University international business professor Noel Moore. He says microloans can be complicated. There are success stories, but the landscape globally is littered with unscrupulous microlenders who essentially morph into what looks like an awful lot like loan sharks.
It is not an easy panacea, nor is it one of these motherhood issues that I think everyone should just sort of blindly get behind. If it goes wrong, it can go really wrong.
The banker we met, Margarita Correa, she says in Colombia, microfinance works, that it's one way to move social development forward. In Bogota, I'm Lorne Madelon for Marketplace.
And on the way this morning, what you might call the car, SUV, pickup truck economic indicator, GM, Ford, Fiat Chrysler, and more will release their sales tally for April. 2015 was a record year for U.S. vehicle sales with low oil prices, but March sales tapered down slightly. The forecast is for a sales rebound in April. We shall see. Our producers are Justin Ho, Katie Long, and Beatty Jong. Our engineer this week is Daniel Ramirez. I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.